are people with poor health conditions, especially those suffering from malnutrition.
The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate health care and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance as well as the Western-led sanctions are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
A lot of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thousands came together for the annual International Quds Day March in the Canadian city of Toronto to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially those in the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian solidarity organizations and communities rallied across from the U.S. consulate, calling on Ottawa and Washington to act urgently to end the Israeli terror campaign and genocide and try to save as many lives as possible.
And this year it's especially important because people are motivated to come out in large numbers to bring an end to this genocide that's taking place in Gaza and underline their commitment to see a free Palestine from the river to the sea and a free Al-Quds, a free Jerusalem, free from Zionism and occupation.
Millions around the world are marching yesterday, today and tomorrow, all week. Thousands of cities and towns across the globe are making Al-Quds Day an international day, a call for justice and freedom, particularly for the Palestinian people as they are facing genocide and war crimes in Gaza.
The city has continued its heavy policing of pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Just 1 week ago, several participants were injured and six others were arrested in the annual Land Day commemoration by the Toronto police, who were captured on camera using excessive force.
So last week, people must have seen the videos by now, but the police completely attacked a peaceful rally, and there was horses involved, and this is what the police do. They're on the side of the Zionists, they terrorize people. You know, a protest, a simple, peaceful protest, you're not allowed. I mean, this is another example of the Palestine exception. That protest is good, it's a liberal, it's a sign of democracy, except when you're talking about Palestine. You can't do that.
Participants also use Quds Day to condemn a recent deadly attack by the Israeli regime on Iran's consulate building in Syria's capital, Damascus.
Well, Iran has been subjugated to all forms of aggression at the hands of the Zionist regimes and their backers. But the last crime that Israel have done in destroying the Iranian embassy in Damascus, that is a zero tolerance. Iran will respond, and I think that Iran is being called upon by the people to respond against this Israeli aggression.
As the targeted killing of civilians and the starvation campaign continue, a temporary resident visa program announced by the administration in Ottawa 3 months ago has failed to bring to Canada any Palestinian relatives of Canadians from Gaza. Against that backdrop, families and activists are pressuring for a real arms embargo on Israel. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
Thousands of Austrians marched under the slogan "Stop the genocide, stop the occupation" in the capital Vienna. The Palestine Committee and Palestine Solidarity Austria organized the demonstration. The march was held on Saturday, a week after house raids of Palestinian activists in the city of Linz. Police recently also interrogated protesters in other cities. International Kutz Day was an aspiration for the organizers of Saturday's protest.
And all these commemoration days is to really say, wake up, we are really in the situation where people are getting killed every day and we have to stop it as soon as possible.
Organizers also criticized a four-day visit of the President of the Austrian Parliament, Wolfgang Sobotka, to Israel this week.
Well, obviously, when looking at the last 6 months, there's been some unconditional support for Israel, obviously, and their action in the Gaza Strip, which is absolutely unacceptable.
Several speakers stressed Austrian solidarity with Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war continues unabated. They said the Austrian government does not speak for them.
It's the most obvious wrongdoing that I've ever seen in my life.
The protesters called for support for Lebanon and Yemen against US imperialist aggression. People from around the world joined the Vienna march.
I was born in Chile under a dictatorship and I have a lot of Palestinian friends. I am even wearing a t-shirt from a team called Palestina, who was founded by Palestinian migrants several years ago. I couldn't be in peace with myself if I wasn't here demonstrating and saying and raising my voice, at least.
Representatives of Jewish organizations such as Not In Our Name stressed their continued solidarity with the Palestinian struggles. Organizers said all Austrians must continue to protest against the US-Israeli genocide and their government support for it, despite the repression.
We cannot call ourselves humans, regardless of our nationalities or political views or religions, and be indifferent about what's going on nowadays in Gaza.
Thousands marched in the Austrian capital Vienna in support of the people and the resistance in Gaza as the Israeli genocide war claims more civilian lives. Despite Austria's repression, the state and the police were unable to stop the Palestine solidarity movement. Saturday's demonstration has once again shown that the support for Gaza remains strong in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
The military parade Hezbollah marked International Quds Day in Lebanon, where hundreds of Lebanese and Palestinians raised their fists in a show of support for the resistance group and its leader. Hezbollah Secretary General underscored the significance of the Lebanese front and raised his voice in response to the Israeli threat, saying the resistance in Lebanon is fully prepared for any war.
The resistance in Lebanon does not fear war. It has managed battle in the last 6 months with a clear strategy and a vision which is complementary to the ongoing battle in the region. The resistance has managed the battle in a manner that would lead to victory while protecting Lebanon. However, it is fully prepared morally, mentally, and militarily for any war which the enemy would regret having launched against Lebanon.
Hezbollah's leader downplayed the ability of the Israeli regime to launch a full-scale war on Lebanon with the fact that it is extremely exhausted and has achieved none of its declared objectives, except for the killing of innocent women and children. And despite the sacrifices, he said, the alliance of resistance is on the path to a historic and major victory.
Based on logic and political, military, diplomatic, regional, international and economic information, we are able to see very clearly what the leader of the Iranian revolution had said during the first days of the war, that Israel will be defeated and that Gaza will be victorious, and Netanyahu will have no choice but to stop the war, which will be a historic and major victory for the resistance in the region.
A significant part of the speech touched upon the Iranian role in supporting the resistance factions and the oppressed people of the region. It also confirmed that the Iranian response to the Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus will certainly come, and that everyone needs to be ready for what may lie ahead after this retaliation.
We are very close to a victory, since the blood that has been shed in Gaza and Lebanon and from all our brothers will be fruitful. This is why this year is exceptional, and it has a very positive impact on our hearts and has given us hope that a big victory is possible.
It's not just the duty of Muslims to take part in Al-Quds Day, but also as human beings all over the world, since it proves their humanity.
We are here not to support just Gaza, we are supporting all Palestine, the resistance in all region. We'll elaborate Palestine and Al-Quds, and we will win, inshallah.
Hezbollah's leader also noted that Al-Aqsa flood has put Israel's existence in danger and exposed its vulnerabilities. And those who should be ashamed are the ones who have normalized ties with Israel.
Al-Quds Day this year is distinct on all levels. Loud actions have been made, not only in support of the Palestinian people, but in establishing what could turn into a tangible plan to end the occupation of the Holy Land. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The International Quds Day this year comes following Israel's airstrike on the consular section of Iran's embassy in Damascus that killed 7 Iranian military officers. This latest Israeli attack, together with over 6 months of regime's genocide in Gaza, prompted thousands of Iranians to pour into the streets across the country to mark Quds Day.
Recently, there was an incident in which we were all heartbroken and devastated, as 2 of the top Iranian generals were killed and our country's embassy was air targeted. This act was against international and human rights law. As an Iranian and a Jew, we condemn this issue.
Quds Day is commemorated all over the world on the last Friday of Ramadan. It is a day of international solidarity with the Palestinian people. Just like previous years, the Iranian Jew community also joined other protesters to express their support for Palestinians in Gaza. This community believes that the United Nations and the Western countries have been totally inactive over the ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip.
We are not anti-Semites, but we are anti-crime, we are anti-killing, and in one word, we are anti-Zionist. And we live in peace with each other in Iran, with Jews, but we don't have any problem with Jews. We have problem with genocide, with killing, with Zionists.
We send a message to all young and free people around the world that humanity is in danger today. Hear our voice, our belief, and our goal. Down with Israel.
This year, the International Quds Day comes amid the ongoing Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Israel has cut off fuel, electricity, food, and water to Palestinians living in the besieged territory.
Iranians once again resonated voices of solidarity with Palestinians on International Quds Day and also strongly condemned the recent criminal acts of the Israeli regime leading to the martyrdom of 2 senior Iranian military personnel. When it comes to violation of human rights, nobody can stay silent. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
This is IOIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli fighter jets have bombed homes in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood. 153 Palestinians were killed in just one day. At least 33,360 Palestinians have been killed and around 76,000 wounded in the 6 month of ethnic cleansing in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the ICJ, International Court of Justice, has wrapped up its hearing of a Nicaraguan lawsuit against Germany, accusing it of fueling the Gaza war by selling arms to Israel. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of the program. Asad Abu Shaq, Palestinian academic and activist, is joining me from Dublin. And Eve Engler, author and political analyst, is joining us from Montreal. Now, welcome to the show, gentlemen. Beginning with Assad, as you know, a large number of IDF troopers have pulled out of parts of Gaza, and you know, at the same time, truce talks have been in full swing in Cairo, of course, without a breakthrough. So do you expect the negotiations to come to culmination and achieve ceasefire, given all the sticking points still remaining there?
Thank you very much indeed for this question. Actually, I do not expect any results from these negotiations, because the Americans are totally supporting the point of view of the Israeli. For example, they didn't call for immediate and lasting ceasefire. They didn't call for the withdrawal of Israeli troops or for the punishment of the Israeli troops for their genocidal war against the Palestinians. All they care for is the Israelis who were held. I mean, the Israeli war prisoners of war who are held by the Palestinian resistance movement. And that after they are released, of course, Israel will be more savage, more brutal, and the ethnic cleansing program and war will continue. The Americans cannot and may not and will not be fair mediators. The Americans represent the point of view of the Israelis. That is to say, the Egyptians and the Qataris on one side are negotiating with the Americans, who are Zionists themselves and representing the point of view of Netanyahu. And up to this moment, they did not negotiate from a neutral point of view, and they did not like to put any kind of pressure on Israel to withdraw its troops. On the contrary, they are putting pressure on Egypt and Qatar in order to put pressure on Hamas to succumb to the Israeli points and Israeli demands put on the table by the so-called American mediators.
Okay. Now, allow me to ask Eve this question. Eve, Hamas has rejected this latest ceasefire proposal presented by mediators in Egypt. It says that it does not meet the Palestinians' demands. It also slams the Israeli Prime Minister's threat that the invasion of Rafah already has a starting date, you know, in the midst of all these negotiations. So does Tel Aviv truly want a ceasefire?
No, I don't think Tel Aviv truly wants a ceasefire. I think that they would, they're under a lot of pressure to not go in full scale into Rafah. I think there is U.S. pressure that would prefer to not have, you know, thousands and thousands more, or maybe even tens of thousands more Palestinians killed. It's becoming a political problem for the Biden administration within the U.S. It's becoming increasingly a political problem regionally, with, you know, Turkey bringing in sanctions, even if those are, you know, ultimately very limited. Also, I think that, you know, you see where the French and the Jordanians and Egyptian leaders publishing op-ed in U.S. media calling for a ceasefire. So I think the pressure is mounting, but Netanyahu, for his own personal reasons, he wants to continue the war as long as possible. He's also, of course, aligned with these totally extremist Jewish supremacists, who themselves have made clear they're going to, they'll, you know, try to have the government fall if they don't go into Rafah. But they don't want a ceasefire. I mean, I think they're being pressured into it. Obviously, when you announce a plan, though they haven't given an actual date for an invasion of Rafah, while simultaneously negotiating over a ceasefire, it's a little bit of a contradictory position. But I think it speaks to the fact that, no, Netanyahu and Israeli government doesn't actually want a ceasefire. They want to continue killing and making Gaza as unlivable as possible.
Okay. Now, Asadla, let me quote something. Listen to this quotation. There is no force in the world that will stop us. There are many forces that are trying to do so, but it will not help, since this enemy, after what it did, will never do it again. This is Netanyahu's words, right? Is he right? No force is able to stop the Tel Aviv regime's atrocities against Palestinians?
You see, the Israel has been created by the West and has been supported by the West, and the volunteers and technology and espionage and weapons and 200,000 bombs from America, in addition to trainers and volunteers and money. And only last week, I think the Americans decided to give $18 billion worth dollars of weapons to Israel. I think if the Americans are serious and honest, not hypocritical, they can just order Netanyahu to withdraw. They did it before in 1956, Eisenhower. They can order him just to withdraw all. But I don't think that the Americans are serious. The Americans, of course, are doing that for local consumption, for their, the election, for presidential election, for and order to fool the Arab and the Muslim world and all the world, the world. But I think the game is exposed, and I think no. Israel, if the Americans are serious, if the Europeans are serious, I think they can put an end just by a telephone call from Biden. But the Americans are not serious. They are fooling everybody. And the Israelis, you see, cannot survive. The Israelis cannot survive, neither as a nation, nor as an army, nor as a leadership, without the, this support coming from the West and from America. Mm-hmm. So this, again, this is a game. The Americans are liars. They are being hypocritical. And look, for example, Biden himself said, if there were no Israel, we could have invented it. And then he said, I am Zionist, and I will be Zionist, and I support the state of Israel.
Right.
And on the 2nd of October, he went with all the leaders of the West. No. I think Israel is surrogate, European, Western state. Israel serves their own interests. It is planted as a dagger in the heart of the Arab and Muslim world to serve the interests of the West.
Okay. Now, Netanyahu has stressed that the IOF will proceed with its goal of eliminating all of Hamas's brigades, in his words, including those in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. And you know, Rafah is where 1.5 million displaced Palestinians are taking shelter, and many are warning that a Rafah attack would end up in a catastrophe for the civilian population there. So can anything justify the planned offensive on Rafah?
No, but I think that you can't justify almost everything that Israel's done in Gaza over the past 6 months. If they do go in, it would be a crime on top of a crime on top of a crime on top of a crime. I think that international opinion has turned so much against Israel that it will be difficult for Netanyahu to pull that off. But they are pretty drunk on their own power, and they have been pushing the bounds of anything that any reasonable person would consider is possible. So I don't think it's I think there's a pretty good chance they're going to try. It will lead to incredible horror, but that sort of hasn't stopped them in the past, and unless the countries that have been enabling the Israeli Holocaust in Gaza, unless they don't just rhetorically say, oh, don't do this, but bring in some concrete measures, and there are a whole host of measures they can bring in. I mean, simply ending arms permits. I mean, very simple things. It's nothing complicated.
Right.
That's a huge message, and it will reverberate all through Israeli political, military life.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, speaking of arms, the ICJ has concluded its second and final day of hearings into Nicaragua's complaint against Germany that's accused of facilitating the genocide in Gaza by supplying the Israeli regime with arms. Now, how effective, in your opinion, could an ICJ ruling be? You know, they have no mechanism to enforce their rulings. Would it be able to force Germany to stop selling arms to Israel?
Unfortunately, you know, the decision taken by ICJ are not binding. They are just recommendations, and they are not binding because, you know, even previously they took, the ICJ took a decision regarding the separation, the apartheid goal in the West Bank, but these are just mere, recommendations or non-binding resolutions. But this is, anyway, it is a step to expose, it's a very good step to expose the hypocrisy and the complicity and the involvement of the West, the so-called white supremacists in the West, who totally support Israel to continue its genocide, which has never, ever been heard in history. But this is a good step, and we call upon the ICJ also to bring all those states, from America to Britain to Germany to everybody who sell weapons to Israel, to kill the Palestinians and to kill, annihilate Palestinian children, men, women, to destroy hospitals, schools, churches, mosques, infrastructure. Everything has been destroyed by Western. Who destroys Gaza? It is F-15, F-35, German rockets, British rockets, French rockets, training, technology, espionage, personnel. So right. The whole West is a criminal. The whole America is a criminal. Germany is a criminal. Britain is a criminal. France is a criminal. The European Union is a criminal. Imagine all the whole world is against the civilians of Gaza. This is ridiculous. That has happened in history. So I think we need not only the ICJ, but the ICC to bring those leaders, being war criminals, to be tried as war criminals, and then to apply also Chapter 7 of the United Nations against the rogue state of Israel.
On the second day of the hearing that was today, Germany argued in the defense that nearly all its military exports to Israel since October 7 have been defensive in nature. They also argued that the ICJ lacks jurisdiction on the case. Now, does ICJ lack jurisdiction in the case? If so, which tribunal has jurisdiction?
I don't think it lacks jurisdiction. I think ICJ, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that ICJ does have a jurisdiction. I think this case is testing some new legal area, but is there are some precedents of officials being governments being held accountable for arming genocide. I just want to say, with regards to the ICJ, doesn't have the mechanism to necessarily enforce a decision. But I think if it does rule, and this is probably not too likely, but if it does do a interim or emergency ruling that says that Germany needs to stop arming Israel, I think that's going to put a whole lot of pressure on the German government to do that. And I would go one step beyond that. my government, the Canadian government, which is the fourth or fifth biggest armor of Israel, it will put a whole lot of pressure, even on the Canadian government, if there's a ruling against Germany, calling on Germany to stop arming Israel. So I think that even if the enforcement mechanism is, you know, they're not going to actually, you know, in the case of the South Africa's case, they obviously, they haven't forced Israel to stop doing its genocidal policies in Gaza. But I think countries like Germany and Canada are in fact much more vulnerable, politically speaking, to an ICJ ruling than Israel is. So mm-hmm. I think it would be quite a significant, it could have quite a significant impact, though I don't think it's too likely that the court's going to, you know, make that interim ruling, but I think it would be quite a good step if it did.
Now, as I said, speaking of Western support for Israel in the war on Gaza, Australia's Defense Department has said it won't release details of arms transfers to Israel because it would damage Australia's reputation. Now, the West, you know, the UK, Germany, the U.S. in particular, they have been selling arms to Israel and has been using them in the massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. The question is, why should all these Western states aid and abet the Israeli regime in its genocidal war on Palestinians?
You know, don't forget that who created Israel? It is the West. Who supports Israel? It is the West.
Right.
Because Israel serves their own interest to keep the Arab world divided and to keep the Muslim world divided, and then to plunder the resources, natural resources, oil, gas, whatever, and to keep the Arab world and the Muslim world divided, and to control that, to keep their hegemony, and to control that part of the world. And this is, of course, at the expense of the Palestinian people. And this is not the first time they do that. You know that in all the wars, they helped Israel against in 1967, 1956, 1973, 1982, in all the wars which Israel launched against the Palestinians, the Arabs, the Muslims, whatever, Israel used weapons supplied by the West. And then Israel, if you want to, from legal point of view, Israel is an occupying power. And Israel doesn't have any right to self-defense. And the Palestinians have every right, according to UN resolutions, according to international law, Palestinians have every right to resist the occupying power. Israel is an occupying power. And then when the Germans say we are supplying defensive weapons, this is rather ridiculous, because Israel is an occupying power. How come that you supply an occupying power launching genocide war against the Palestinian people, and then now you say this is these are defensive weapons? You are violating international law, you are violating humanitarian law, you are also violating your democracy, or the so-called democracy or human rights, which you have always been regurgitating and mouthing in the West. So I right. think Israel serves the interest of the world. Israel is their wild dog, wild wolf, which they unleash whenever they like against any Arab or Muslim country that opposes them.
I see. Now, if Palestinians returning to their homes in Khan Yunus after the Israeli army's withdrawal, they're expressing shock, you know, at the scale of destruction there. You know, how things are. Infrastructures in ruins, no hospital left, you know, no schools, public schools. Most of them have been totally or partially destroyed. So who's going to have to foot the bill for all this massive and unprecedented destruction?
Well, in a just world, of course, it would be Israel and Israel's sponsors. In the world that we live in, I don't know who. There's going to probably be some effort to get some Middle Eastern, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar to fund reconstruction. But at this point, I mean, I think that it's still a long way off before the, you know, reconstruction kind of takes place. But I know, I think in anything approaching a just world, Israel, of course, would be the main government responsible for compensating Palestinians, and then countries like the U.S. and Canada that have been involved in enabling the destruction should also be contributing, because the destruction is just every different story from every different angle. You hear about, you know, from the destruction of agricultural lands to the destruction of all the hospitals, to the destruction of all the universities, to the destruction of all the buildings and the homes. It's just unbelievable. The degree of mayhem that Israel has waged in Gaza in such a short period of time. There's these images of Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, after 2 years after Russia's war, which everyone in the West says is so brutal, and it's all, you know, everything's basically in order. And then next to it is, you know, 2 weeks into Israel's bombing campaign in Gaza, and, you know, most of Gaza City is already destroyed.
Exactly.
So it's stunning.
Yeah. Asad, my last question. Some countries have been mulling according recognition to Palestinian statehood. You know, it's the war, lots of people in it have been killed, lots of also material human losses in this genocidal war. But there are also some good aspects, like countries like even the UK, Ireland, Malta, Slovenia, Spain, Australia, they're floating this idea of recognizing a Palestinian state. So it looks like that this war has also somehow benefited the Palestinians, you know, in terms of their bid for statehood. And also, just yesterday, they applied for full UN membership. Don't you agree?
You see, we have 1,000 resolutions in the United Nations calling for our, for example, resolution 19, 2326, right. It calls for our right to self-determination, our right of return and compensation, our right to statehood and sovereignty, our right to resistance. Now, if the West is honest, and they are not honest, and they are hypocritical, if they are honest, all they need to do is to implement UN resolutions taken by the international community.
Right.
Some of them agreed to these resolutions. So, and if they cannot do that, now it is high time for them to recognize Palestine as a full-fledged member state of the United Nations, and to recognize our right of self-determination, which is very, very important,
okay. And
our right of of compensation and return to our property, homes from which we were uprooted.
Okay. I'm sorry for jumping in. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have had. Thank you, my guests, Asad Abu Sharq, Palestinian academic and activist in Dublin, and Eve Engler, author and political activist in Montreal, Canada. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Doctors at the University of California, San Diego's Health Trauma Center have treated 455 patients with serious injuries sustained whilst trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in 2023. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge has sharply questioned the Biden administration's position that it is not responsible for housing and feeding migrant children while they wait in makeshift camps along the U.S.-Mexico border. Recent media reports have shed light on the harsh conditions at sites along the border, where people waiting for processing by U.S. immigration authorities live under open skies, or in tents, or in structures made of tree branches. The camps are often short on food, short on water and sanitation, relying on groups of volunteers to distribute aid and basic supplies. Border Patrol does not dispute the conditions at these camps. Rather, the question at issue is whether these people are in legal custody, which would start a 72-hour limit on how long children can be held and require emergency medical services and guarantees of physical safety, among other things. At a hearing in Los Angeles, California recently, the U.S. District Judge Dolly G said evidence presented by migrant advocacy groups appeared to support the definition of legal custody. She asked, are they free to leave the camp? Fiza Batul, an attorney for the U.S. Justice Department, answered, as long as they do not proceed further into the United States. U.S. District Judge Dolly G, who was appointed by Bill Clinton, acknowledged it was complicated, like dancing on the head of a pin, because some children arrive on their own at the camps and are not sent there by Border Patrol agents. U.S. District Judge Dolly G did not rule after the half-hour hearing. Advocates are seeking to enforce a 1997 court-supervised settlement on custody conditions for migrant children, which includes the time limit and services such as toilets, sinks, and temperature controls. Children traveling alone must be turned over within 72 hours to the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, which generally releases them to family in the United States while an immigration judge considers their case for asylum. Asylum-seeking families are typically released in the United States while their cases wind through the courts of law. The legal challenge focuses on two areas in California, one between two border fences in San Diego and another in a remote mountainous region east of San Diego. When the number of people crossing the border was particularly high last year, they waited for several days to be arrested and processed by overwhelmed Border Patrol agents. From May to December, agents distributed colored wristbands to prioritize who to process first. Migrant advocates say Border Patrol agents often direct people to the camps, sometimes even driving them there. Agents are often seen nearby keeping a loose watch until buses and vans arrive. The Justice Department, which rejects advocates' label of open-air detention sites, says smugglers sent people to these camps. It says agents giving them water and snacks is a humanitarian gesture, and that any agent who sends or even escorts them there is no different than any law enforcement officer directing heightened traffic to avoid disorder and disarray. Brent Schwertfeger, a senior official in the agency's San Diego sector, said in a court filing, Border Patrol generally arrests people at the camps within 12 hours of encountering them, down from 24 hours last year. The agency has more than doubled the number of buses in the San Diego area to 15 for speedier processing. On Friday, 29th of March, 33 people, including two small children, waited between border walls in San Diego until agents came to ask them to empty their pockets, remove shoelaces, and submit to weapon searches before being taken in vans to a holding station. They were primarily from China and India, with others from Afghanistan, the Republic of Azerbaijan, and Georgia. Border agents spoke to them in English. Pedro Rios, a volunteer with American Friends of Service Committee, delivered turkey sandwiches and hot tea and coffee through spaces in the border wall. He gave pain relievers and ointments to a limping Chinese woman who had fallen from the wall. Doctors have seen a startling rise in injuries related to the border wall, with one San Diego trauma center treating more than 440 patients with serious injuries in 2023 alone. Kellyan William, a 38-year-old, said she left a 10-year-old daughter with family in Jamaica because she could not afford the journey, including airfare to Mexico, but that asthma would have made the trip difficult for her child anyway. She planned to apply for asylum and settle with family in New York area, having fled her home after family members were killed last year. Kellyan Williams said she attempted to reach the camp on Wednesday, 27th of March, but fled back into Tijuana in Mexico to avoid Mexican authorities in pursuit. She tried again a day later, waiting 6 hours on U.S. soil for agents to pick her up for processing. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Doctors at the University of California at San Diego's Health Trauma Center have treated 455 patients with serious injuries sustained while trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in 2023, a marked increase from the previous year. Alexander Tenorio, a resident neurosurgeon at the University of California, San Diego, who treats brain and spinal cord injuries, said 97% of the injuries, or 441 of them, occurred when people fell off the wall on the U.S. side of the border with Mexico. The figure captures just a part of the number of people injured while trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border near San Diego. The center is one of two major trauma centers in the region. Migrants with injuries perceived as less severe may not make it to a hospital, and children are not included in the data set. Still, they highlight the extensive and growing human toll of the border crossing. In 2022, the trauma center recorded 311 injuries relating to people scaling the wall. In 2021, it recorded 254 injuries. In 2020, there were 92 injuries, and in 2019, there were 42 injuries. Tenorio said a lot of these patients come with fractures all over their bodies. Unfortunately, and that's what you would expect if someone falls 30 feet from a wall, it's like a three-story building. Dr. Tenorio said the patients arrive at the trauma center with broken limbs, abdominal organ injuries, facial injuries, and spinal fractures. Dr. Tenorio said a lot of these injuries unfortunately don't heal on their own because they're so severe and extensive. He added, a significant number of patients end up undergoing emergency craniotomies or spinal cord surgery. Of the patients who underwent these spinal cord surgeries, Dr. Tenorio said, only 14% came back for a clinic visit, making long-term outcomes difficult to assess. In 2023, Dr. Tenorio said the center for the first time saw more women than men admitted to the hospital for border-related injuries, including falls.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Occupation forces killed over 120 Palestinians in 24 hours.